1982, and this is the second session, Bill Senator Mel Fidler. We ended up talking about the Ketchikan Bar, and you were saying that it was a social organization, and then I wanted to ask you about W.C. Wolford Bill Stump.
Right. Bill graduated from the University of Washington Law School in the early 30s. And came back to Alaska to practice and had a very successful practice.
What kind of law did he practice?
Everything. Again, general practitioner. You had to be a jack of all trades. You could not afford to be a specialist.
What was particularly interesting about, what were the years he was practicing first?
Let me see. From the early 30s up until about 6 or 7 years ago, at which time his son took over and Bill became semi-retired.
He wasn't a solo practitioner, though, was he?
At one time he was, and then his half-brother, the late Ernie Bailey, E.E. Bailey, and he set up partnership, and then Ernie Bailey died several years ago, and then Bill's son, who graduated from Gonzaga, Clark, joined his partner, his father, in the practice of law, and then subsequently Bill retired, leaving Clark as a sole practitioner. Clark took in two young men with him, Jeffrey Curl, C-U-R-R-A-L-L, and Clay Keene, who is the son of the district court judge. Been there for many, many years. Retired Coast Guardsman, Henry C. Keene, Jr. Clark ran across the contretemps. And about 2 years ago, he was disbarred for a five-year period. And prior to his disbarment, Clay Keene and Jeff Curl struck out on their own in the practice of law. So the Stump firm, as such, is no longer existent.
When you went to practice in Ketchikan, with your father and
Walter King.
Did you have dealings with the Stumps?
Yeah,
was it Stump and Bailey?
No, it was not. I think it was just Bill Stump then, and Early came in a few years later. But again, my recollection as to dates is hazy, which is only understandable. It's been more than 30 years ago. And mostly the firms were in a friendly but nonetheless adversary position. We would find ourselves, as would Judge Gore and Bob Jernberg, you had three major firms, or practitioners, as you will. And obviously, since there are at least two sides to all litigation, we were mostly in an adversary position.
Did you split the work of the big companies among you? Or did any of you have the sole rights over some of the big companies?
No. In those days, retainers were a little bit more popular than they are now. And I'm sure that the firm of which I was a member had its fair share of retainers. Mm-hmm. I can't speak for the other firms, of course, but I imagine that retainers of have almost been relegated to a thing of the past in my part of the world. I can't speak for Anchorage or Fairbanks or what have you.
You want to tell me the role of retainers when you were practicing? What it entailed to be on retainer?
It meant nothing except for the fact that should your client require counsel, you would be available for that purpose and you would undertake no representation. ethically you couldn't, inimical to that of the client. In other words, you were paid a small premium to assure your impartiality and availability.
And why did they become less popular?
I don't know. You have to ask the clients who used to pay retainers but don't anymore. Mm-hmm. And we're getting so modern now that it's not unheard of for people to go to Juneau, going north, or to Anchorage for counsel, or for that matter, going to Seattle for counsel.
Mm-hmm. Well, did that happen while you were practicing?
Or the trend did. The trend did. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Progress, I suppose you would call it.
Who were the first ones to go for outside counsel instead of
I don't know. It seems some of the corporations, maybe some of the salmon canneries who had local counsel, also had house counsel down in Seattle with whom we would work. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, Pam, it was no biggie. It was just a course of attrition over the years, and it was certainly no great loss. When you say retainers, you're talking about maybe three or four a year, and I don't think we have any left now. But we have certain valued clients. Whom we would not represent in an adversary. You know, we simply couldn't, ethically.
So it's understood.
I think so,
yeah. You're just not paid the premium that you were before.
You're just not paid the premium. That's right. That's right. Stipend would be a better word than premium, but
I'm going to backtrack a little. Your father and Chini started in Juneau,
mm-hmm.
and then your father went down to Ketchikan. Why did he go down to Ketchikan?
Well, I think at the time that he and my mother went down to Ketchikan in 1919, I think the idea was to set up a branch office for the firm. And then I think after Zig had been there for a while, it was by mutual agreement. I'm sure they never had a harsh word. It was just decided that Zig would just go out on his own, mm-hmm. maintaining a friendly relationship with Mr. Cheney.
Was he doing more business than Mr. Cheney?
I would have no way of knowing that.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure earlier that Ketchikan had larger business prospects than Juneau.
At that time, state government or territorial government was still in its infancy in those days. And Ketchikan had more business interest, I think, than Juneau. Juneau had a coal storage plant. We had 17 salmon canneries in the area and a sawmill right in the heart of downtown and a few logging camps. Juneau, then as now, was primarily a governmental town, only not on the same scale that it is today. And they had more of a fishing industry then, I guess, than they do now, and not too much in the way of timber.
Were there other attorneys who came down from Juneau to practice in Ketchikan, or even branch offices?
Well, that could have been, but I don't know. I don't have any personal knowledge. You see, I was 10 years old when I left in the early 30s, and I didn't come back full-time until 1948, so there could have been all kinds of people flapping around back and forth. I just don't know.
Yeah. What kind of judges did they have in Ketchikan when you were practicing there? How did they work the judge system?
Well, we had a U.S. District Court judge. Most of them, as I remember, traveled the circuit. They would be in town for 2 months or 6 weeks or whatever, then they'd get on an Alaska steamer and go to Wrangell or to Petersburg or to Juneau and hold court there. You had a clerk of the court in these communities who stayed there all the time. And then, of course, you had the traveling clerk of the whole judicial district who more or less traveled with the presiding judge. But in other words, they had their own their own court reporter and the clerk of the court and the judge, and maybe one or two of them had clerks, I don't remember, and that would be the traveling court party. And then in each town you would have a courthouse or a court facility at least, which would be staffed by maybe a file clerk and a deputy clerk of court who were there full time.
Where was the court in Ketchikan?
In the old federal building, where it stayed until we built a new state office building some 10 or 12 years ago in Ketchikan.
And how often did the court come down to Ketchikan?
I can't tell you. I would guess probably 3 to 4 times a year.
Who were the judges while you were there?
Well, when I was a little boy, we had a Judge Reed, and we had a judge, well, then we had Judge Fulta, who was there when I got out of law school in 48, and George died, I believe, George W. Fulta, in 1955, and then when Fulta died, no, we had one in between, Walter Hodge. And then we had Judge Raymond J. Kelly from Illinois, who was been on the Railroad Commission, and I think he was a past national commander of the American Legion. And he was succeeded by Judge Walter E. Walsh, Walsh, S-H. And Walter, I believe, made the transition from U.S. District Court Judge to Superior Court Judge in the state court system. I'm not sure about that, but I'm pretty, you know, that's recollection. Well, I'm
before you enter politics, I think that's before you just so late.
Okay. Well, I was with my firm from 48 to date. Chuck Cloudy having joined the Ziegler King and Ziegler firm in 1951, and I became engaged in politics in 1957 when I served in the 23rd and final territorial legislature. And I got active again in politics in the election of 1964, and I've been in the Senate ever since. My practice nowadays is in the nature of being semi-retired. That is, I go to the office, I will work, but I am not for the courtroom scene anymore. I have a theory that anybody over the age of 50 should never be engaged in courtroom trials.
Why?
You burn out. It's a young man's game. I really think that.
Were you a trial practitioner?
Oh, yes.
Litigator?
Oh, you bet. We all were in those days. You had to be to survive.
So there were very few deals with that, or it was mostly courtroom?
Any competent attorney tries to negotiate the settlement of these cases if he possibly can. Some are incapable of negotiations. As a result, you went to trial. Sometimes with success and sometimes without.
But you didn't have any specialists in the 50s?
No.
General practitioner.
Well, yeah, okay, but it's not true. Obviously, we didn't advertise in those days, like come to to Ziegler for the best deal on Dom Rell problems or what have you.
But
domestic relations.
Thank you.
You took this course in college.
No, I
can't. Oh, didn't you? Well, you should have. But
it was women in the law when I
did. Oh, okay. Well, I think maybe in a small town, the word would get around. For example, if you were an injured worker, I think maybe somebody would say, well, go see Ed Ginger or Joe Blow, whoever, because he does pretty good. He helped me out when I busted my leg. And somebody else would say, well, if you're really having trouble with your wife, you'd better get Walter King to represent you because he's a tiger, or go see Bill Stemp because he'll get the bottom dollar on a settlement. You know, I mean, it's word of mouth, but you don't and didn't hold yourself out to be a specialist. But I think perhaps in the public mind, there were certain attorneys who were better than others in certain areas of endeavor. I think that's true of anything, doctors, dentists, or what have you. Everybody knows everybody else in a small town. And
So Ziegler King and Ziegler were domestic relations?
No. At times, pro or con, you know, defending or on behalf of the plaintiff. I didn't mean to say that at all. I said, for instance, certain lawyers would get reputations for doing certain type legal matters better than anybody else in town.
What were you known for doing better than anybody else in town?
Too bad I can't bring back my late father, I think, for being conscientious and capable attorneys, but I'd say that about anybody else in town, so. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that we were better known for those qualities, because we weren't. Bill Stemp was known as a very aggressive plaintiff's attorney, and he had some remarkable results over the course of the years. He did. Lester Gore was and Walter King were both known as excellent paper men. They were not what you would call hotshots as trial attorneys, but they were very thorough, good paper men. In other words, a lease strung by either one of them or a contract involving real estate would be letter perfect. You know.
Mm-hmm. Did partnerships usually form with people having different skills? I mean, you obviously are a litigator and speak well on your feet.
Well, I don't know. I don't think you could characterize the firms. That's what you're trying to get me to say, and I don't think that's true. I don't think that was accurate. I think that in a small town, in other words, the way it works generally is, suppose that my father, who would have been 90 had he lived to the day, had many contemporaries. And as time goes by, and as he became less active and I became more active, I think the children of his clients would come to me or Chuck. It was a pattern. And as long as Cloudy and Ziegler, young Ziegler, you said word advisedly, were giving adequate legal services, I think we just inherited, or we were the inheritors of a successful pattern of a small town law practice. You know, we're still probating wills that my father and Walter King drew 30 and 40 years ago. And presumably, my successors will be doing the same thing in 10 or 20 years with the wills that I've been drawing since 1948.
What made you get interested in politics?
Well, I don't know. That's a hard thing to say. A lot of people urged me to run. And number two is my father had done it before me. And I liked what I perceived at the time to be the excitement of it all. Plus the sort of corny or hooked up statement, having been here all my life, and not yet I haven't, but intending to be here all my life, I think you maybe like to feel that perhaps you've left Alaska a better place than you found it, you know?
Was it common for lawyers, looking at your background and training, was it common for people of your training to go into politics?
Well, let's put it this way. Within my legislative experience, it was not uncommon to find many attorneys serving in the various legislatures. Nowadays, I don't believe we have but one in the House and two in the Senate. And I like to think that the lawyers are the oil that makes the legislative machinery run smoothly, but you have to have good partners, or you have to have a little bit in the way of independent means, or to have some sort of an independent income to serve in any profession. And it's too bad, I think, because I think lawyers really do make the whole thing work that much better. Well, because they have a flair for language, they have a flair for compromise, they have a flair for sniffing out the possible that many times other legislators, not because they aren't brilliant or whatever, they just aren't as experienced in the ways of making things work as lawyers can be.
When there were more lawyers in the legislature, when you started, there were more lawyers than there are now. What were the differences in the kind of legislation that was coming in? Can you see any differences?
No. We probably got there a little bit faster, though, and perhaps with a minimum of friction. Apropos of what you're saying, an old friend came by and left me this thing. Okay. This was the Senate in 1965. And looking over the list here, well, there's Egan, and there was a then Secretary of State, Hugh Wade. He was an attorney, as I recollect.
Yeah.
And then we had President of the Senate was an attorney.
Who was that?
That was Bob McNeely. And I was the only other attorney then. There were just two of us then. In subsequent years, we've had more. In the 1957 territorial legislature, we had a whole passel of attorneys.
Why have they decreased in number?
Primarily to make a better living elsewhere. Mm-hmm. It goes back where, right behind you. Thank you.
Have you encouraged other lawyers? Have you tried to, or do you think that they should be encouraged?
Well, yes. I definitely favor more legal talent in the legislature. It's doubtful that the situation is going to change, though, because lawyers, like everybody else, have economic constraints. And if you're a sole practitioner in a two-man partnership, kiss your clientele goodbye if you're going to be out of your office for 6 months a year.
During the time you practice, of all this time, what's been your most enjoyable type of practice?
There's only one happy thing a lawyer ever does, and that's handle an uncontested adoption. That is the only happy thing a lawyer ever does.
Are there any things that are challenging, or have politics taken the place of...
Well, you mean, can you have two loves? Yeah, you can. Sure you can. Politics has not replaced the practice of law, but I'm realistic enough to say that what with the devotion of X number of hours of your time or X number of days or weeks or months to the legislative arena, that your practice has to suffer proportionately, not only in terms of your clients, but in terms of what you can do for them, and in terms of perhaps not staying as smart as you should be as to what's going on. What I'm trying to say is that I would be very cautious in the future, as I have been in the past, about the type representation I undertake, simply for fear that I may be doing somebody an injustice by not knowing as much as I could about any given proposition. I realize the books are always there, and so are the younger attorneys. Okay.
Senator Robert Ziegler, I wanted to talk to you about the court bar fight, what precipitated it, and your involvement in it.
Well, at the time that the fight came to a head, I was the president of the Bar Association, and then Chief Justice Nesbitt, Buell Nesbitt, decided that the Supreme Court was much better qualified than the Bar Association to handle the affairs of the Bar Association. That is an oversimplification, but in essence, that's what the argument was all about.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any dealings with Buell Nesbitt?
Only at the point of a gun, which is literally true. When things came to a crisis, we had the bar bank account in an Anchorage bank, and it was anticipated that some raid on the treasury was in the offing, so we surreptitiously had all that money transferred down to me in Ketchikan, and I put it in the First National Bank of Ketchikan. The name of the bank account was Alabarez, short for the Alaska Bar Association. It was some $30,000. And immediately after the money had been transferred, why, Judge Stewart and a state trooper went in and at gunpoint, I am told, told the cashier that they were impounding any funds belonging to the Alaska Bar Association. Of course, there were none. And my understanding, trooper even had the gun drawn. I wasn't there, of course. But anyhow, shortly after we had arranged for the transfer of funds, I received a telegraphic writ of sequestration signed by the Chief Justice telling me to remit forthwith any funds over which I had direct or indirect control to the Supreme Court. So, you know, what in the hell are you going to do? I sent the Chief Justice a wire saying it will not be necessary for you to send an armed trooper after me. The money is on the way. And we sent it to him. We eventually got it back.
Let's go before the money got sequestered and all this kind of stuff. What happened at the very beginning? How did this all come about?
Well, I think I inherited the problem. When I came into the presidency, the trouble was already brewing.
Were you on the Board of Governors?
I've been on the Board of Governors. I'm one of the few that's been on for 2 3-year terms back to back. And if recollection serves me, I was the president in the 5th year of my total of 6 years on the Board of Governors. And I truthfully forgot whom I succeeded, if that's the right word. Whom I followed would be the better word. And it was war. It was declared war, because I felt, as did all the other members of the bar, with maybe a few scattered exceptions, that we were certainly qualified to conduct our own business, and perhaps more qualified than the Supreme Court.
Why were you more qualified?
Because we knew the needs of the bar better than the Supreme Court. We were practicing attorneys. We knew what was good for us. We knew what was bad for us. We likewise knew what was good for the people we represented and what was bad for them. And the Supreme Court in those days was icily aloof. They were just bound and determined that nobody could question their authority. Certainly nobody could attempt to usurp whatever authority they had. And an interesting sideline to all this is that the Bar Association appealed, maybe not appealed, but we addressed several questions to Justice Harry Aarons, now deceased, I believe, a highly respected trial lawyer, before he went on the Supreme Court bench. And we asked him 6 or 8 questions as to why all these things were happening, to what degree or extent did he participate in everything that had happened, and how did he really feel. And he did not bother to reply to us. The bar then, perhaps with the most political clout it had ever wielded up to that time, and certainly since then, mounted a campaign to non-retain him, to vote for non-retention of Justice Harry Aaron. And we did. We dumped him. And that's one of the few times, if not the only time, in Alaskan history, or certainly the only time a Supreme Court justice has ever been dumped by the populace, and one of the few times any judicial officer has been bumped or dumped by the voters. I don't take any particularly pride in this, but we never got the degree of respect from the Supreme Court to which I and my colleagues thought we were entitled. We were a fledgling bar, and we were flexing our muscles.
But they were a new Supreme Court, too, weren't
they? Well, whether they were new or whether they were old does not and did not lend any credence to their position, which was that we are infallible, and we know what's better for you, and you know what's good for you. And they tried to ram it down our throats. And lawyers, like any other Alaskans, were notoriously independent, and we would have none of it.
The bar hired, was it Joe Ball and and Talbot was the representative from the bar?
Calamides?
Talbot? Who? Was,
Dave Talbot?
Dave Talbot, right.
Yeah, Dave Talbot and Joe Ball, I think they represented us. I've forgotten who represented the Supreme Court, but we had a 3-man tribunal, and one of the three, I believe, was Dean Schweppe, who was the former dean of the University of Washington Law School, and recognized as a very, very capable attorney. And the Board of Arbitration really cut right down the middle of the difference of, between the two opposing feuds. And they came up with a solution which no one was really fond of. We all could live, because the Supreme Court had a much tougher tiger by the tail than had been anticipated. That would be my guess.
I remember going over some of the minutes from the bar during that time. And part of it had been to take the case to the district court instead of having this 3-man tribunal, and I guess Dave Talbot had made some overtures to Ball, and they had started making motions toward the district court. Do you remember any of that stuff?
No, I don't. I don't. It did not go before the district court. Something could have been filed, I don't remember. But actually, the end result was achieved through the three arbitrators, yes.
Is there any reason why they wouldn't have wanted to go through the district court?
Maybe they thought they'd get a better shake from arbitrators.
I think that the district court might favor the judges.
Could have. And we're still in territorial days.
No, actually, this was after territorial
days. Oh, yeah, that's right, sure. This was in the 60s, sure. Yeah. I don't know whether it was just at that stage of life a general fear of all judges, irrespective of where they were. And we thought we'd be better off with illustrious people like Schweppe, and the other two, the other two guys were just top drawer people too.
With the court bar fight, when did it start? What were the immediate?
Well, I think, and again, my memory is very hazy on this. I think that they were proposing rules and regulations pertaining to the way we should conduct our Bar Association affairs, and we thought it was officious in her meddling into an outfit, or instrumentality, as you will, which was doing a good job of conducting its own affairs. Mm-hmm. And we didn't need their meddling.
Did the legislature have any kind of anything to do with this? Were they
The legislature had little, if any, thing to do with this fight.
Were they proposing any
As I say, I wasn't here, and I don't remember any lawsuits.
The reason a lot of people say that Harry Arens was unjustly taken to task for what the Chief Justice, what they felt was the strong...
He brought it upon himself. He was not unjustly. I think it hastened his demise. But if he'd had the courtesy to answer some questions which were put to him in good faith, I don't think the end result would have been the same. Mm-hmm. So Justice Arens, in my opinion, I'm not going to say he got what he deserved, but he brought upon himself what happened. And all he had to do was sit down and answer some questions which any damn fool could answer in a half an hour. Mm-hmm. And at least, even if he disagreed with us, we would have known where he stood and why. But since he ignored us totally, we declared war.
Did this whole effort unify the bar in any way?
For a long time it did. Yeah, we were really a solidified group.
Mm-hmm. Had they been very unified before? I mean,
because it was a fledgling organization. It was feeling growing pains. But by and large, we were a small bar. And we thought... more or less is with one mind. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody condemned our conduct as being outrageous. On the other hand, I would think that most attorneys who were on the scene and active in those days felt, as I did, that we were doing everything we could to protect our association, and we didn't have to have a bunch of judges running around doing unprovoked good unto us, you know. We were perfectly capable of managing our own affairs. Justice Arens was a fall guy, but that still does not excuse his failure to communicate with us when we gave him a bunch of questions, mm-hmm. to which, the answers to which we thought we had coming. Yeah, really. And so we declared war and carried the day.
Was that your last, were you in bar politics after that point?
Not really, because once you served on the board for 6 years and all the various committees, and once you've run the show for a year, I don't say you're necessarily over the hill, but there's always young, fresh blood coming on, and they want to run the show the way they feel it should be run.
Why did you get involved with the bar for that 6-year term? That's an awful long time.
Why did I get involved? Because my colleagues elected me.
You must have sought it at least.
I did not campaign. They knew I was available and I would serve if elected. Mm-hmm. And I was. So it's all there is to that. It was no big deal.
Mm-hmm. Were you on the Board of Disciplinary Procedures or whatever?
At one time.
When Neil McKay was barred?
Uh-huh. I think Justice Boutchever and I were on that same board. Mm-hmm. And as I recollect, we were two of the members who urged disbarment. I've forgotten for what period of time. Uh-huh. But we were overruled. And I think this is just so sketchy, but I believe we felt that Neil had overreached with an elderly client in connection with certain real estate in Anchorage. Mm-hmm. Based upon what was before us at that time, I have no compunctions.
Do you remember who the other members on the disciplinary committee were?
No, and I should. I should, but I don't remember. Mm-hmm. But it's in the archives, someplace.
They don't think they let you see disciplinary procedures.
Well, I just don't remember.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, you agreed that he'd be disbarred. So when it went to the Supreme Court and they agreed with you, you didn't have any feeling that the bar hadn't done its duty, is that?
Oh, no. What the hell? Whatever happened, happened as a result of majority vote. Mm-hmm. And I've forgotten what the Supreme Court did to him. What did they do?
I think they suspended him or something. I'm not sure.
For
but
a short period of time, though. Yeah. Well, as I recollect, Neil was represented by Wendell Kay, who is one of the all-time great practitioners in Alaska. And I know how tough Wendell can be because I've been involved with him in a couple of criminal trials many years ago in Southeastern. A tremendously impressive attorney.
What was his technique like?
Technique was he was an accomplished orator. He understood human nature. And he knew his law. See, he had everything going for him. Still does.
Has the bar stayed fairly cohesive since the court bar fight? Or has it?
I would say, yeah, by and large. The board now, as I understand it, is kind of split between the, and I don't mean this derogatorily, the traditionally conservative type lawyer and your young hotspurs who want to revamp every damn thing mm-hmm. without knowing any specific reason why, except maybe they feel a change is desirable. But that's somebody else's worry, not mine.
What about the practice of law over the time that you've been practicing? Has it changed greatly?
Change, but not greatly. And I would say that whatever changes have been made in Alaska have been made throughout the United States. I mean, you know, we're off on the radical courses up here that
when you were first practicing, was it the same as everywhere else in the United States?
I would have no way of knowing. Not having practiced everywhere else in the United States, I would have no basis for comparison. But we all read the same books in the same cases. Mm-hmm. And we all generally subscribe to the same systems of office management. So,
so you don't think Alaska shows any kind of different, it can be held up as an example of a different kind of practice than any
I don't think so. I think by and large, we have an extremely talented group of up-and-coming attorneys. I don't know whether you could say that would be true in all other jurisdictions in the country, but I think by and large we have a group of attorneys. There are, there, you know, there's got to be a few exceptions, but a group of attorneys who probably would rank as high as any other organized bar or even unorganized bar any place else in the States.
A little bit about politics and lawyers. Have I know we talked about it before that there are fewer lawyers in politics. When you first came into the bar, was there a sort of obligation for you to pick a party to be a part of and to be involved in politics?
There was no obligation, but living in a small town prior to the days of TV, you had to do something to keep from going nuts during the long Alaskan winters. And so I assume that not only the lawyers, but most people mm-hmm. were more actively engaged in partisan politics. Mm-hmm. It was an outlet, a method to blow off steam.
Did the bar in Southeast reflect, even though you say most people, was there a difference in the bar? Since more people were involved in politics?
I don't think so. No.
there anything else that you want to add?
Nope.
Say that?
Nope.
Thank you.